It was an unexpected thought that started me on my homiletical path this week. The thought, believe it or not, was poor Herod. It wasn't meant in a flippant or ironic way. It didn't discount the horror that this gospel passage ends with. It simply came from a realization that when we first meet Herod in this passage, he is trapped, isolated in a world of his own making, but alone nonetheless. And try as he might, despite all of the wealth and power that surrounds him, all that Herod can see is the darkness that he has made. And once I realized this, came that most unlikely thought, poor Herod. Our gospel today is strangely interesting in another way. What you may notice in our appointed text for this morning is the presence, or more specifically, the lack of presence of Jesus. Jesus himself plays no direct role in this story, through word or action. The only mention of him in this text is at the beginning, in the opening verses, and it is only because people are talking about him. Apparently, his work and the work of his disciples was having an effect because people in the region are making his name known, enough so that his name reaches the royal court. And yet, in a theme that will be echoed a few chapters later when Jesus asks the disciples who they think he is, apparently there was a debate going on in the community about just which category to place Jesus in. His wisdom and his deeds have mystified those who have encountered him. Some say that he is John the Baptizer, others a prophet, and still others that he is long-awaited Elijah. And it is here that our narrative takes this interesting and unexpected turn, because now our story focuses on Herod, his strange reaction to the news that there is someone with powers like these at work in the region, and we come to the reason that he seems such a pitiable figure. As far as we know, and the text is sparse like much of Mark's gospel, as far as we know, Herod does not ask for any member of the court to learn more about this potential prophet in the countryside. He is just sure of who this person is, and he declares, "John, whom I beheaded, has been raised." It is for us, the reader, to wonder why in the world would Herod think this? What could push him to such a declaration? And this then brings us to the second interesting aspect of the gospel passage, because the rest of our passage this morning seems to take place in Herod's mind. It is like a dream sequence, continuing with a narrative of the past, one that must be playing over and over and over again in Herod's head as he sits alone in the shadows of his decision. It's because of this that I have an image in mind of Herod alone. No matter how many courtiers and aides and officers there are in the room, he is alone, frightened of the news that has just been delivered. Frightened because he is sure of what has come to pass, that the prophet John the Baptizer, whom Herod has wrongly and knowingly murdered, he is sure this man has been raised. He knows that this must be what has passed. Now, this may sound far-fetched, but can be a familiar sensation for some. I mean, have you ever been in a crowd and caught in a glimpse, and you have been sure, absolutely sure, that you see the face of someone from your past. Someone no longer in your life, lost in some way. And even though it cannot be possible, there in the crowd they were. It seems to me this is something of a sort of what Herod was experiencing. He had been the one, after all, as we heard in our story, that had ordered John's gruesome death in order to preserve his own sense of power in front of his birthday guests. And yet, as he sat alone in the darkness of his palace, there was no doubt for Herod that John had been raised and that his sin still lay before him. And because of this, Herod sat alone. Alone in darkness, barely keeping fear at bay. Now I realize that the story of Herod is almost fantastical. Who among us has birthday parties with courtiers and officers and the political and economic leaders of the day? I'm guessing none, except for maybe His Honor Willie Brown. I mean, that parish, the shindig he had in Paris this last year sounded pretty good. Few of us have our daughters perform at such functions or have kingdoms to promise half of. And though I don't think that any of us have come close to the decision that Herod faced, the awful power over another's life, it may well be that some of us have been forced to choose whether to follow our own ill-conceived words or to humbly acknowledge our fault. Or maybe in our desire to maintain authority, we, like Herod, have been tempted to sacrifice others to maintain honor, prestige, or power. Regardless, though, I'm sure that many here today have spent hours, days, or maybe even years in the darkness of loss that enveloped Herod. Unlike Herod, however, rarely does this sense of loss come to us warranted. Sometimes this sense of emptiness, the emptiness of life, comes through disease, either in ourselves or in those that we love. And many times there is little or nothing that we can do but endure. And so we do. Other times, especially recently, this void comes with the loss of employment, destroying our sense of security, of normalcy, and sometimes even our sense of identity. This sense of loss comes through the fracturing of relationship as well, whether in the form of divorce, of estrangement with children, siblings, or parents, or through the demise of a relationship. Regardless of how it comes to us, the emptiness created by loss is a lonely, foreboding place to live. For many, it is easy to slip into that space where it seems as if there is no other, and simply to despair. And yet, friends, it is even in the midst of this that we can claim a hope that pierces that darkness. It is the calling of Christian community. Because at the very core of the Christian faith is a belief in the strength of interdependence. As you may have heard me say before, there is no one Christian. You cannot exist by and for yourself and at the same time worship a Christ that existed to be with the other. Our very essence as Christians is found in the Southern African tradition and theology that is serving as the theme to this year's General Convention of the Episcopal Church, meeting right now in Anaheim, the theology of Ubuntu. Ubuntu, we are people through other people. We know of ourselves because of the relationship that we share, beloved by Christ, together children of God's adoption. And just as David did not carry the ark of the Lord alone, none of us carries the burdens, the losses, the pain of this life on our own. It is for this reason that today, especially today, we celebrate for the gifts that we gather, bless, and share this day. For today, we commission 6 Stephen ministers, followers of Christ among us who will walk with us in the emptiness of the void, in the darkness of the shadows. These Stephen ministers, who range in age from their 20s to their 70s, have been called, nurtured, and prepared for just this walk. With the support and guidance of the Stephen leaders and of me, these 6 Stephen ministers will be here so that none need walk alone. They will listen, care, pray, and listen some more. They will walk with us in places that we, like Herod, fear most, in the places of loss, of emptiness, of loneliness. And by their care, they will serve as a living reminder of the healing love of God that endures in even the darkest of times. I would like to close with words that were preached just a few days ago by the leader of the Anglican Communion, the Most Reverend Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury. He has come to be with us at our triennial convention, where we as an Episcopal church pray and listen, lobby, argue, cajole, and legislate about the concerns of the church and of the world. He preached these words in the context of what it means to be Christian, namely, that it is fundamental to our beings as Episcopalians that we are in relationship with other Anglicans around the globe. We cannot pretend as if our words and our actions weren't felt and deeply by others with whom we are in relationship. And yet his words are just as true for us as Christians at All Souls Parish in Berkeley. We too must remember that no matter how dark the night may be, this is a path that we do not walk alone. Archbishop Williams. Life is proclaimed not in our achievement, our splendid record of witness to God, but in our admission of helplessness and of the continuing presence and lure of death in our lives. To be able to speak of this and not to retreat in fear or throw up defenses is part of true life. It is to know that our name is spoken by the Word of God and that we do not have to battle in resentment and anxiety to create an identity of our own. It's already there. We are already called friends. We are already bound to each other, and our life is invested in each other, in those we see and those we don't, those we like and those we don't. We are in the holy place with Jesus, a holy nation, a royal priesthood. He continues. Here at the Eucharist, we state who we are and where and why. We give voice to our hunger and helplessness. We name death in us and around us. We give thanks that we are called from emptiness to life and that our own true names are spoken by the Word. May this gathering be a sign of life in the face of death, a declaration of who we are in Jesus and with another, in the heart of God, the Holy Trinity, chosen friends who miraculously know something of that God's longing for what has been made.